So without further ado, Nick Selby.
Hi, everyone. Hope you still clap once I finish. I'm going to sit down. I timed it. It was 9 minutes 50, so hopefully, right. A tiny poem in Creeley's 1969 collection, Pieces, reads in its entirety, cup, bowl, saucer, full. Here, words and things, poem and surrounding world, open into and nest within each other. On a tiny scale, this poem figures how reading Creeley's poetry provides a model for better reading the world we inhabit, a means of exploring how a poem's nature, as words on a page or a screen, is intimately bound to external nature, as, in this example, the clay from which such domestic objects are made, or the food that they hold. So today, what I want to talk about a little is the sequence Numbers, which is also from that collection, Pieces. And I want to suggest that not only might we be able to trace or feel that there are connections between Creeley's poetics in this sequence and those of the New York School more broadly, but also that in Numbers we might start reading Creeley's as an incipient ecological thinking. Today, then, I'm going to sketch out some initial thoughts about this sequence, thoughts that will eventually be part of a chapter on Pieces for the book on Creeley that I'm currently writing for Palgrave, with the title Creeley Poem World, On the Limits of Ecological Thinking. This book argues, and I think counterintuitively, that over its course, Creeley's work develops an ecological consciousness, and that through close readings of his poetry, we might therefore explore the extent and limits of what prominent ecological thinker Timothy Morton has called the ecological thought. Patently, Creeley was not an eco-poet. However, his work, I think, continually touches on the entanglement of poem and world and of the vibrant connectedness of the internal and external environments it encounters. So with this at the forefront of its close readings of Creeley's poetry, my book sees him as a limit case for ecological thinking, and it asks what the consequences are of reading his work as fundamentally environmental in its concerns. In Numbers, Creeley treats the numbers 1 to 9 and then 0, and Robert Indiana's pop art inflected screen prints of those numbers as the material, the stuff from which his poetic sequence is generated. It was written at an important point in Creeley's career, with the collection Pieces, in which Numbers appears, are often seen as marking a distinctive shift in Creeley's poetics. Prior to Pieces, Creeley saw poems as largely discrete and autonomous objects. With this collection, though, his idea of the poem as just one thing in an ecology of things shifts markedly. No longer autonomous lyric units, the poems in Pieces perform their connectedness to each other and their surroundings through an idea of sequence and a sense of ongoingness, issues upon which Numbers as clearly directly presses. What I'm arguing then is that Numbers, and Pieces more widely, enacts the sort of vibrant poetic economy, and that's a quote, that is, in Jane Bennett's words, a quote from Jane Bennett, resonant with, quote, an ecological sensibility. Brought together in 1968 by Bill Capps, who was working as Robert Indiana's assistant at the time, Creeley and Indiana collaborated on Numbers, with each poem in the sequence a response to Indiana's sequence of colourful screen prints of the cardinal numbers, as you can see. The prints and poems, alongside translations of each poem into German by Klaus Reichert, were published as an art book of 2,500 copies in 1968. Numbers thus emerges, as both Alexandra Gould, Gold and John Yao have pointed out, from the practice of a thoroughly collaborative poetics. I think in this respect, it's reminiscent of, say, Joe Brainerd's collaborative work with numerous New York School poets, as well as the broader collaborative ethos between visual and verbal that energized New York poetics. As with such, oh, New York School poetics, as with such New York School collaborations, maybe the Vermont Notebook we might think of, Creeley's poems are not strictly ekphrastic. They don't simply describe Indiana's numbers so much as respond to their material conditions, to the figure in front of us, and meditate on the associative connections that each number holds for Creeley. In the poem 3, for example, Creeley contemplates how the number 3, both visually in Indiana's rendering of it, and conceptually, proceeds from and adds to the imagery of couples in the previous poem. They come now with one in the middle. That's the one in the middle, yeah. Either side, thus another. This opens up Creeley's poetic space to a sense of the potentiality of things, of choices in and of the world in which the poem finds itself. Here, forms have possibility. When either this or that becomes choice, this fact of things enters. I want to suggest that Creeley's attention in numbers to the fact of things entering the poem provides one sense of measure of the development of what I call in my book his lyric ecology. Throughout numbers, Creeley's attention to number, to sequence and connectedness has a double effect. Firstly, the sequence breaks open the very idea of number as an organising condition of a sense of individual and thus, however troubled, lyric subjectivity, selfhood and subjectivity. As Yao points out, these poems, quote, invite us to consider the role numbers have in one's life. They expose, that is, a key condition of late 60s American subjectivity, namely how senses of self seem to be shaped increasingly by cultures of counting and accountability, Vietnam body bags, for example. So, in the sequence's opening poem, we see Creeley pushing further at the troubled sense of lyric subjectivity explored so extensively in his earlier work, marking the visual similarity between the figure one and the first person I. Creeley asks in number one, who was I that thought it was another one? Such insistent questioning means that towards the end of the sequence, the singular upright flourishing of the figure one has given way to senses of multiplicity and vibrant connectedness. Thus, in the poem entitled 9, Creeley writes, there is no point of rest here. It wavers. It reflects multiply. Such wavering and such reflection are key, I think, to Creeley's ecological thought, precisely because they sense a dissolution of the boundaries between poem on the page and things out there, between word and its figuring of the world. And secondly, numbers thus opens itself to various senses of family and community, the commons that become so important in Creeley's later work, that those senses that are, like numbers themselves, bound together by sequence, addition, multiplication, and by patterns of connection that are visual as well as social. Thus in 5, Creeley writes, from each of the four corners, draw a line to alternate points. Where these intersect will be 5. 5 is also, he notes, a way to draw stars. I think here Creeley instantiates in this poetics of numbers a new stance towards reality, in Olson's terms, that reflects a vibrant poetics, in Jane Bennett's and Timothy Morton's terms, of interconnectedness, of a fuller sense of the vital matter from which numbers, selves, poems, and the universe, that which encircles us, our ecos, is constituted. Not only do these figurings of five describe a network of relations that, not unlike New York's grid system as a model for New York school poetics, a system that moves inwards to points of intersection and outwards to the mapping and eventual numbering of the earth and indeed the stars. But they also draw us into such poetic accounting. Reminding us of Indiana's drawings of numbers, Creeley here also implies that we must act, that we must draw our own lines of connectedness between intimate and expansive experiences. And that is, finally, I think, an ecological thought. There you go. Is that 10 minutes?
Thank you. Bang on. Thank you.
There you go.
We'll take questions at the end, so if you have a question for Nick, please write it down or secrete it and then unveil it.
Email it to me.
Email it to Nick or whoever you wish. Better if you email it to Nick. So, Martina, can I ask you to join us? Thank you.
I'm so glad to be here. I'm a bit stressed, but as you can see, I will talk about Joe Brainard, who's my favorite artist, and also the topic of my master thesis. And the title of my speech is, I can't believe that when they see me and talk to me, they will still want me. And it's social and artistic insecurities in Joe Brainard's letters to Ron Padgett, which I will present later because I was honored to be given the letters by Ron Padgett, by Joe Brainard to Ron Padgett, so I have Joe Brainard's handwritings included here in the presentation. I will analyze them later. And the first part of my speech includes I remember, because I want to analyze briefly the self Joe Brainard creates in I remember, and then move on to Bolina's journal and the different self he creates, and then compare those two with the self he creates or not in the private correspondence with Ron Padgett. So to begin with, I remember, which was published in 1970, is an autobiography in the form of non-chronological remembrances and memories by Joe Brainard. With the initial phrase, I remember. And in this book, Joe Brainard doesn't really refer to his emotions, but to details that he remembers from the past. And all the memories contain neutral memories of food he used to eat and films and books he used to watch or read, the artists he admired, and school, church, and family and friends memories. But when it comes to family and friends memories, he doesn't really refer to feelings, but to, for example, colors of pieces of clothing or the toys they shared and stuff like that. Yeah, so it wasn't really connected with the emotions he had and the family connections he had with his family. And Paul Auster, in the introduction to I Remember, said that by writing I Remember, Joe Brainard presents courage in revealing things about himself, often sexual, that most of us would be too embarrassed to include, which I agree with, because after reading I Remember, I had to close the book several times, rethink what I have just read, and then go back to reading. Yeah, because some of the fragments were even too detailed, yeah, and I think it would be too embarrassed for all of us to include them in our memories. Yeah, but maybe that's what I love Joe Brainard for, yeah, that he's shocking and amusing at the same time. And when it comes to the self he creates in the book, he's an honest narrator marked by an incredible openness, an ability to recollect and describe various unexpected, provoking and embarrassing details. And as I said before, he doesn't mention feelings and emotions here. It's just details and objects, books, films, and things like that. But the things differ a bit when it comes to his other memoir, which is Bolinas Journal, published in 1971. And I agree with Timothy Keane that it's a memoir of disappearance and even anti-memoir. Because in this case, he also he describes his daily life in Bolinas using separate fragments and small drawings. And it's unordered as well, as in I remember. But in this case, I think he focuses more on his feelings and emotions. And why I, well, the reason why I consider the book as anti-memoir, and I agree with Keane, is that he, I mean, Joe Brainard really wants to get rid of his painful internal experiences and negative feelings that he had. So he tries to draw colorful pieces or, I don't know, funny comic stripes, but we can see underneath that there is some deeper meaning. And as I said here, the narrator focuses on emotions and uncertainties. And I think he tries to escape from his bad memories. So it's like a shower, after which he wants to wipe the wrong feelings off. And as I summarize the part of this presentation, is that the analysis, the Bolinas Journal is the analysis of what Joe Brainard was trying to forget rather than remember. Yeah, so I think he wanted to just wipe off the things that he really wanted to forget. So it was like, yeah, like a cleaning his soul also or something. And here we have Joe Brainard's letters to Ron and Pat Paget from 1965 and 1966. And the letters are mentioned a bit in Ron Paget's memoir, which is called The Memoir of Joe Brainard. And the chapter in which he includes the letters is Between Paris and Avenue B. And there we can read several fragments. And yeah, these are fragments from the collection of Ron Paget's private correspondence with Joe Brainard, which I have here with me. So if anyone wants to take a look, I have 250 pages. So you're free to. Yeah, and it was really difficult to choose the 9 fragments I want to discuss here. Yeah, but I managed to do it. And as you can see, I have a question, like the last part of the slide, because I think that when we read private correspondence, we want to see the person who he or she really is. And here I said that Joe Brainard being Joe Brainard is presented in the letters, but are we sure? I don't really know, because while reading all the letters, I felt like there is some pattern, some repetitive phrases, and I wasn't really sure if Joe Brainard really wanted to talk to his friends, as I said, here, because he spent a lot of time separate from his friends, and it was kind of friends conversation with no author and reader relationship. But on the other hand, as I said, there is some pattern that Joe Brainard follows in the letters that you will be able to see underneath. So let's move on to the slides. Yeah, so this is Joe Brainard's handwriting. I know it's quite long, but I chose only one fragment, and I'm not sure if I'm able to. Okay, so this is one of the things I wanted to mention in the topic, because I mentioned insecurities. And here in this line, I think we can see one of those, which is definitely an artistic insecurity, because Joe Brainard was respected and a very, very talented artist. And here he's like, he's not really sure what he was doing. And he says, I am working with Sky. I am also working on 2 constructions, both of which are driving me crazy. I do insane things to them every day in hopes that something unbelievable will happen. Yeah, so for the audience, his works were unbelievable, and he himself didn't really believe it. And if you want to take time to read the whole part, just...
Don't, because we haven't got time.
Okay, we have no time. Okay, so we have to point to the next part. Here we can see some examples of his social insecurities. I think this one isn't that clear because the question mark here is the point. Because as Ron Padgett remembers in his book and recalls in his book, Joe Brainard used to stutter a lot, and he wasn't that sure about his English, and he considered himself as a bad English speaker. And here we can see the openness he had towards Ron Padgett and Pat Padgett, because he said it's an undercurrent of sarcasm, and then quotation mark, is that the correct spell? So he wasn't afraid to ask his best friend about the mistakes, the spelling mistakes he makes, for example. And here we have the next one, which is strongly connected with Joe Brainard's hardest issues, I think, because he wasn't so sure about his look. And that's why he always wanted to make himself look better. And here we can see that he tried to use a lot of things to improve his body, let's say. And he says, I'm taking pills to get normal. Yeah, so that's what he thought, that maybe he was, I don't know, weird or something. Trophite, vitamin B and vitamin B12, what they do is to make you hungry. So I eat a lot and then you gain weight. Yeah, because he considered himself as too thin. So here we can see definitely social insecurity or even self-insecurity, because it's kind of visible. Here we have, I think here in this slide we can see Joe Brainard's insecurities and sense of humor at the same time, because he says, I die laughing every time I read it. It was about his short story. His short story. I die laughing every time I read it, and it is a good thing that I do, because nobody else thinks it is funny. And this phrase... he uses this phrase a lot in the letters, because when he writes something or drew something, he was always like, oh, I'm not sure if it's good, so Ron, Pat, please judge me or give me your feedback. And the last, I think this one is too long, but here I wanted to mention this fragment that's because Joe Brainard used to pose for Alex, and he was just like a model for pictures, photos and paintings. And the fragment says that he was also unsure about his body. So he says, I posed for Alex again the other day. What I like about posing is that you can just let your mind wander, and I rarely give it that chance. Yeah, so he was kind of a problematic person, I think, and he had a lot of issues that made his life much more difficult than maybe it really was. Because he, even though he succeeded a lot, he wasn't really sure if his works, as I said before, were good. And this is what Timothy Keane mentions as well, that his Joe Brainard's private life was successful, but her mental things were not ordered, and he needed some time for himself. And in this fragment, I want to present Joe Brainard's wonderful sense of humor again. And it's not about insecurities, but maybe. He says, Pat, are you really pregnant? I told Sandy and Kenward that you might be pregnant, and they both seem very happy about it. I'll be glad if you aren't. But then, I'll be glad if you are too. And this is what I love Joe Brainard for. Thank you.
Thank you. So next, Helena.
How do I switch? You could just like
press space.
Space to switch sides, okay.
Yeah. All forward and back. That's the first slide.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. My talk is called In Forgotten Letters. And it's based around this theme of open reading, which Brona actually suggested to me. And to me, that phrase kind of calls to mind the capacity that Ashby's poetry has to accommodate lots of different interpretations and readings without one needing to kind of supersede the others. And that's obviously true of a lot of poets, but it does seem particularly pronounced with Ashby's work. So There are readings that view him as an environmental poet. There are Marxist readings that view his poetry as being about work. There are readings that focus on his response to the AIDS epidemic. And all of these can feel as if they're fully engaged with the poetry and they can be persuasive without one needing to be definitive. So really I've been wondering what it is about Ashby's work that makes this possible. I think it's tempting to see it as a byproduct of the poetry's own openness and open quality that it possesses, but I think we can probably all agree that Ashby's poetry isn't open in the way that, for example, confessional poetry is open. Even if, for example, we think about a more kind of subtle definition of openness, I was looking at Umberto Eco, who's written about the poetics of what he calls the open work. He talks about it in various ways, but he comes back to this idea that an open work has a kind of structural incompleteness, so that the interpreter of it, whether that's a reader or a performer, receives it in the form of a set of possibilities that need to be then organised and even kind of literally assembled to create the work. And he gives examples of some musical works by Stockhausen and Pierre Delay, and Ashby was a big fan of those guys. And his work does gesture towards these kind of aleatory contingent practices at times. But still, I think the kind of definition of openness that Eco is giving us doesn't really encompass the effective dimension of Ashby's poetry or its ambiguity and the complexity of its address to the reader. And more importantly, I think the idea of a blanket openness doesn't really describe our experience of reading Ashby. And what has really caught my interest in thinking about this topic is the kind of contrast between, on the one hand, the breadth and also the specificity of the kind of interpretive acts the poetry enables, and on the other hand, our experience of it as deferring meaning or keeping meaning from us or hiding something, that is, being everything but open. Catherine Brillio has written about this in terms of what she calls Ashby's reticence. She talks about his ability to enclose and disclose at the same time, and I've kind of borrowed those terms from her because I think they're really useful in thinking about how we could reconcile the poetry's openness to interpretation with its reticence, its ambiguity, its elusiveness. I want to kind of ground this in one quick bit of kind of close reading. It's just a couple of lines from Ashby's long poem, Grand Gallop, which appeared in Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror. We're told that still that poetry does sometimes occur, if only increases in forgotten letters packed away in trunks in the attic. So I've always been kind of intrigued by this image of poetry being kind of enclosed within these various structures, obviously kind of affective and perhaps also the internal structures of memory, but also very literal structures, domestic, material. And we have this word in repeated four times in these three lines. And that suggests that some very literal acts of opening are taking place, that we can arrive at this poetry in inverted commas. There's the opening of presumably the door to a house, the door to an attic, the lid of a trunk, an envelope, and ultimately these texts, these creased letters. And obviously I'm reading these lines in a very literal and material way, but I think they provide a good analogy for what's going on as we read Ashby's poetry, because there's a lot of apparent opening happening, but actually nothing definitive is being disclosed. All we're really given is just this kind of oddly neutral assertion that poetry does sometimes occur. I think there's perhaps some playful echoes of Auden's Poetry Makes Nothing Happen in there. But whatever we're looking for, whatever we feel like we've been promised, seems to kind of disperse and disappear and slip away at the last minute into these texts, these forgotten letters. And I think it's important they're described as being creased because we're given the sense that there's not even the possibility of a kind of definitive final disclosure. There's always more space, there's always more opening that could happen. In fact, I'll even say that any kind of evocative power that this word poetry has in these lines is a result of it being envisaged as enclosed and somehow inaccessible in these various ways, of us having to follow this complex process of opening to kind of find or situate it. And what we're left with, in lieu of this definitive opening, is just the spaces and the objects the poetry is called into being. So a house, an attic, an envelope, a letter. Ashby acknowledged his tendency to do this. There's this quote from the Norton lectures where he's giving a Q&A to some students, and Richard Howard ends up telling him, they wanted the key to your poetry, but you presented them with a new set of locks. So what's being suggested by Richard Howard's comment, and also in the lines we just looked at, is not a semantic transparency, a straightforward openness. Instead, it's imagined as a very spatial act of kind of disclosure, a process for opening that results in the creation or discovery of new sites and objects where meaning might potentially be found. So I thought about potential comparisons for this kind of play between openness and enclosure. One might be Mallarmé. Ashby had read Mallarmé and translated some of his work. And I was thinking particularly of Mallarmé's Eventail poems, written on fans that the reader can open and close. And as they do so, they compress and expand the language of the poem and they create new relationships within it. Craig Dworkin has called this a mobile play of revelation and concealment, which seems to me to describe kind of what's going on as we read Ashby. And I also thought about Emily Dickinson's Envelope poems. These again suggest a poetics of immediacy and friendship, and also one that doesn't depend on this single definitive act of disclosure, but rather on an ongoing dialogue and response. And Dickinson even included a pencil with her envelope poem, so her correspondent wouldn't have an excuse not to write back. So both these objects, Mallarmé's fans and Dickinson's envelopes, give us a very concrete sense of openness as a kind of accessory quality, a kind of byproduct of something being touched or handled or put into motion or exciting someone's interest in some way. And I think that also applies to Ashby's trunks and attics and letters. These objects and spaces aren't open in and of themselves, but they can adopt open positions and can potentially disclose what they contain. And I think there's perhaps a play here with this idea of articulation. These objects and spaces that are articulated, that can open and close, also have some kind of latent capacity to articulate, to communicate meaning in some way. Quite often what is undisclosed in Ashby's poetry is some sort of queer meaning or context. And I think this idea of a capacity to open rather than a straightforward openness is really useful to understanding how this queer content is both kind of hidden and visible in his work. We might even want to, we might even want to relate the kind of enclosed domestic spaces that Ashby's invoking when he talks about opening attics and trunks to the emblematic space of the closet. And when he writes later in Flowchart about the linens folded in my scented cedar closets, I think he's very knowingly making that connection. So the mobility of these objects and spaces, the fact they can open and close again, means that the content that's revealed by their movement has a kind of temporary and contingent quality, and also, I think, a kind of deniability. There's actually a nice illustration of this in an anecdote that Ashby has told to a few interviewers over the years, and this quote is from a 2005 interview. He's describing how his mother found out he was gay by opening and reading a letter that he'd written to a friend and left on his nightstand. So she brought it up one day in the car. She was very upset, but after that it seemed to him that she managed to forget the distressing information, for she continued to ask him about girlfriends as she always had and never mentioned the subject again. So the queer content that's been carefully enclosed in this apparently private space of the letter can be suddenly and dramatically disclosed and then just as suddenly enclosed again. When it's in this space that can open and close, it seems to kind of hover between being public and private, between being visible and hidden. And of course, this is a very literal forgotten letter, perhaps like a willfully forgotten letter in this case. So there's lots of letters in Ashby's poetry. And of course, letters were important in his life too. He wrote to other New York school poets. He wrote to his family when he was in Paris. He wrote to Joe Brainard. And there's a reply from Joe Brainard on the right there. And yeah, when we read his work, we encounter a lot of letters, and a lot of them are either just being opened or not yet opened, and we're not exactly sure what kind of address they contain. We obviously get the sense they can enclose hidden, secret meanings, queer meanings, but I also wonder whether Ashby's references to letters and envelopes and telegrams, particularly in these poems of the late 60s and early 70s, and this same poem, Grand Gallop, has a reference to a letter on a tray whose message is to change everything. And I wonder if that would have made contemporary readers also think about the Vietnam War and the thousands of letters and telegrams that were sent out to tell people that their relatives were missing or had been killed in action. So we have these folded and creased letters that may or may not have what we think of as poetry within them. Often we're not really sure who they're really addressed to or if what we find when we open them is going to be a very personal and specific meaning, something mysterious, something that's either comforting or unsettling. And I think that's really true of Ashby's address more generally. And I like Ben Lerner's description of responding to Ashby's you being like waving to somebody who might have been waving to somebody behind you. But I think this is really key to enabling those kind of readings that can kind of span across or even jump between kind of personal, intimate contexts and then broader, more social, even ecological or political contexts. So letters really represent this kind of broader tension between openness and enclosure in Ashby's work. And one result of the tension is difficulty and the complexity of his poetry, its opacity, its unpredictability. But I also see it as a kind of generosity in all senses of the word, a willingness to expand that is expressed in spatial and affective terms in the poetry. So with this capacity and willingness to open, Ashby provides us with these new spaces into which we can expand our understanding. And within these ambiguous spaces, which oscillate between being open and closed, this huge variety of readings is available to us.
Hello everyone, my name is Sonia Quintero, and my presentation is about poetry with an accent, and I would like to start actually with a poem.
frontera. It just happens, sin que lo puedas evitar, as you leave your loved ones behind, una parte de tu identidad se rasga. You stop belonging. Dejas atrás lo que fue, believing nothing has changed, y sin notar que, de cierto modo, you are not the same. Levantas vuelo con tus raíces y tus sueños, in search of possibilities. Por un tiempo respiras y vives in the land in between, ansiando a final welcome. En esta tierra de nadie, construyes visiones temporales anchored in a future que brilla a lo lejos like a mirage. You continue pursuing that permission to exist, creando realidades liminales as you breathe. Cada día sientes that you're getting closer to home, sin darte cuenta que estás estancado en la frontera. It's just a matter of time until you notice el jardín que has plantado, porque la estadía va para largo. And uncertainty goes well with childhood memories. Respiras hondo, sin poder aceptar that for a while, este será tu hogar.
This poem was written for members of Newham Poetry Group that I founded 7 years ago. So we write the poems together in Spanish and in English. So I arrived to London 15 years ago. When I lived in Colombia, that is my country, I published 7 poetry books. I was writing several articles in magazine and newspaper. But when I came here, I didn't speak any word in English. Only hello and excuse me. That's all. It was helpful. But you can imagine how frustrating it was in the beginning, because writing was my way to express my feeling, my thoughts, my opinions, my theories. And suddenly I was like, oh, I cannot express all these things. So I remember the first 5 years living in London, I spent then trying to fit in the country, in the culture, try to learn the language. So I say like, okay, I'm going just to be focused in learning English. So I completely forgot about my Latin American roots. I never attend any event or anything about Latin America or in Spanish. I was focused trying to learn the language. And I remember I was in my ESOL class and I said to my teacher, you know, in 6 months I'm going to learn the language enough to write poetry in English. And she would look at me and say, okay. So I was quite naive, I know. But she said something interesting. She said, you can learn enough vocabulary, probably, but to learn the culture is going to take you all your life. And that's true. It's still true. So after 5 years, really tried really hard to learn the language, and I was not writing poetry in Spanish, not writing in English, because I was in that kind of limbo, you know, like, I don't know English enough, and I have forgotten somehow my Spanish roots. So I was in that moment, and I was thinking, no, I need to back to my writing in any language, doesn't matter, even if it's a good English or no English, and Spanish, whatever, but I need to come back to my poetry. So I start to knock different doors, looking for the right group that actually allowed me to feel that I belong there, and I didn't find that. So I think, okay, so there is nothing that I can feel like I belong to, so what I'm going to do now? So what I did was start my own group. So I went to my local library, it's in Stratford, East London, and I knocked the door and I say, I want to have a poetry group. So they say, okay, what do you need? I say, just a table and a couple of chairs, that's all. So they say, okay, and I say, it's going to be in Spanish, because it's my language. And they say, no. In Newham, we spoke more than 100 languages. So come on, try to do that one in English. I was, okay. That one was 7 years ago, so I did a chance. They give me the table, the chairs, and also free coffee. And that one was key. That's so important. So I was there for 3 months without no one around me, not even one person. But the people from the library really helped me, and they would start to promote the group and help me with the marketing and all this kind of stuff that I didn't know at all. So then the people start to come from different countries, people from Afghanistan, Bangladesh, people from El Salvador, Bolivia, different countries. After 3 months, we have 25 people coming every single week to the group. It was 7 years ago, and it's still stronger and stronger and stronger. In these 7 years, we have been publishing our books, people that never write before, and also published in different languages, because many of us have language barriers, so we still keep writing our poems, like the one that you just listening. We have a poetry school. We organize the poetry school. We organize open mics, spoken words, and we have, with the help of the council, we start a poetry house. That is basically a council building that they provide us to have a venue only for poetry, to write poetry. We have a library of more than 1,000 books, only of poetry, that have been donated by the community. And we have every week there our sessions that is about reading, writing, or just sometimes just having a coffee, to be honest. So it has been a really nice journey, but also learning what poetry means. Because for many of us, the meaning of poetry is very Eurocentric. So what we have been doing in this weekly session, actually, is written about indigenous people, indigenous poets, queer poets, African poets. So we have people from Sudan, we have people from Nigeria, Uganda, from Bolivia, from El Salvador. All of them try to read poems that actually are completely different than the poems that we normally read about. So it has been like, for us, poetry is all this thing. Poetry is about a bridge that allows us to cross different languages and different cultures. If you can imagine 25 people, completely different people, from different backgrounds, different education levels, different languages, different everything, sexual orientation, everything, but we come together only just to write and just to enjoy poetry. It has been a bridge. It has been also a new language. So sometimes we don't understand what the other one is reading about, but we enjoy because we allow people to write in their own languages, as well as me. It has been also a very way to descolonize a little bit what is poetry. Because if we start to read about indigenous people, indigenous poets, trust me, the storytelling and the way that it's like a lyrics, it's quite like a music and sounds really different. And we try to actually honor from where we come from with our poems. Poetry, as I say, is a language itself. So we communicate with poems, even if we don't understand the meaning of the poem. So this is a poet and poems for us in the group. We have organized also poetry festivals that we are going to have one in September. You are very welcome to join us. So we try to have people in from different spectrums of life coming together to join us. What is most important for me is that during the weekly sessions, we try to break the rules in a good way, in the best way, about poetry. Whatever we think is poetry, we try to do something different, something that is coming from our heart. And when I say that we are writing with an accent, I'm not telling only about a different language, but it's also the accent of the heart. That, I think, is the most important one. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you. Hi, I'm Matt. I'm from Kirby Lonsdale. Has anyone heard of Kirby Lonsdale in Cumbria? It's quite a lot of hands, actually, isn't it? Weirdly enough, so Kirby Lonsdale, it's a place where a lot of people in London kind of go to get away from everything being London. Meaning that where I'm from is the middle of nowhere. There are 2,000 people. That many people know a place with 2,000 people. But for me, yeah, for like, and this is a thing that I still kind of struggle to get my head around. For my entire upbringing, that was everywhere. You walk in 10 minutes that way, there's a field. You walk 10 minutes that way, there's a field. It's just 2,000 people, fields, no public transports, no Ubers, no taxis, and no poetry. And that's where I grew up. And like most people that grow up in that town, the thing that you then do is get as far away as possible. Not that it's a bad place, it's a really lovely place. I mean, all of you apparently know that. But it's, yeah, so I went to Birmingham because it was the, it's the second biggest city, it's got the second biggest poetry scene. And loved it and got really into sort of a lot of grassroots art. I was running like the student poetry open mic in that city for 2 years. And then the weirdest thing happened, which was that someone in my town said, I've got £5,000, who wants to run a poetry festival? So suddenly that was happening, and I was like, I'll have it. And I happened to be on a year abroad at the time in the Netherlands, which meant organising a festival from another country on Zoom while doing a full-time degree. Having never run a festival before, I did not know how to do that. And that's what we ended up doing, and that's kind of what I'm here to talk about today, really, trying to create something like this from scratch, this Kirby Lonsdale Poetry Festival. I'm trying to think, what do we do? I was going to say this earlier, this is kind of the literary history of the town, I guess. Wordsworth wrote about it, Turner painted it, Ruskin and Defoe both absolutely hated it, they really did not like it, and the Brontes all got traumatised right down the road, like 2 minutes down the road. So that's what we got. We wanted to do something to make poetry accessible, fun, celebrate the town, get as much of the town involved as possible, support emerging writers, create a bit of a scene. I've actually got this on here, is a zine that got made by the festival's amazing photographer, Smiller, which I'll hand round. Please don't break it, it's the only one in existence. Next time we do this, because we will do this again, we want to find a risograph, yeah? We don't know anyone with a risograph. But this feels like the correct room in which to mention that. We are looking for one of those. Quite.
Footprint poetry in Leeds.
Yeah?
Footprint poetry. Footprint
sharp. We'll talk. Good. It worked. We ran this festival. It was fun. What happened? What did we do? First of all, I didn't want this festival to just be people come to the front and lecture and read poetry. I didn't want that, no offence. Just because I know my town. I know that's we're a rugby town and that would not sell. So we ended up doing loads of stuff. We had performances. We also had workshops. We also had a kids hub in a yurt that no one turned up to. We had plays. We had flash mobs. I sent a bunch of volunteers into the elderly home to do stuff with the old people. We had a panel about poetry and the climate crisis. I don't know if there's a picture. Typewriter busking. You've probably come across this, right? Like someone's sitting there with a typewriter and then someone comes up to them and says, I want a poem about this. And they say, okay. And they write it. So this is my town. This is kind of people going around it. It was beautiful. We had the events in 11 venues around the town. I don't know why I did that. This is the open mic. Headlines by these two. This is Swerve and JD. They're a rapper and DJ from Barrow, and they do, which is where they have like all the nuclear submarines and that kind of thing. And they do like hip hop about walking in the fells. Like it's actually wonderful. I went into my schools, like the school in my town in the months leading up to the festival to promote. And showed them these videos, and all the kids got so hyped about seeing like rap about where they're from. It was incredible. They came and they headlined at that. These kind of open micers. Most of these people had never been to a literary event before. Workshops. More workshops. Right. Okay. So yeah, our headline events were all in this church. We actually got a really good lineup. I was really surprised. We did this all on a mates rates and volunteers and a shoestring, really. But we got people. I'll kind of say some names. So we had Luke Kennard, who had just won the Forward Prize for best collection. See, I knew it'd be a difficult sell because some of you will. I think a lot of you will know. He wrote this book. Each poem was responding to one of Shakespeare's sonnets. right? But then I was like, how do I sell Shakespeare and Chloe Lonsdale? What I did is I got a local actor to dress up as Shakespeare, and then I made them battle. Like, Luke did his ones. So it's like the greatest poet of our time, according to the Forward Prize, and the greatest like writer in history. And they kind of competed, and then the audience decided who won. So Luke Kennard is actually the best writer in history. Just a little update for you all. And then Kim Moore, who is from Cumbria, and was at the time shortlisted for the Forward Prize, and then obviously won. Jasmine Gardosi, who's doing amazing things with combining like beatbox with poetry. Savannah Brown, who got a lot of people my age into poetry and is a Londoner, and is the reason why a lot of us got into it. Slam champions like Elliot Wallace-Check, Erin Bollins, Hannah Hodgson, who's kind of the other young poet in my county, who's got a life-limiting illness and is kind of like a disability rights activist. And the whole time, this is kind of August 2022, but was still isolating when most of us were roaming the hills. I don't know. But she like came in on a live stream, which was pretty incredible. These are plays that we had. This is a series of plays about Keats. Poems. So like I said, Ruskin didn't like the town, but he also had this, there's like a viewpoint from my town that he called the greatest view in England, therefore the world. Our town has got two tourist attractions. There's a bridge that was built by the devil, and there is and there's Ruskin's view, which is actually now inaccessible. It's being undercut by the river. It's kind of all exacerbated by climate change. It's no longer accessible. So my town is half as good as it was. They're now raising quite a lot of money to save that. And it turned out that a few years before, the BBC had commissioned me and three other poets to write about Ruskin's view. So we had like an event to try and raise some money for that. That's kind of like a... Oh yeah, I'll talk about the volunteers a little bit. They came from everywhere. We just put the word out, and they came from all over the UK and the Republic of Ireland. Just this incredible group of mostly queer young poets. This is definitely the most queer representation my town has ever seen. Probably the most young people my town has ever seen. I will be honest with you. They were amazing, and they came and they brought this incredible life and joy to it, and put their all into it. And we made something really incredible. We really did. And so we're going to do it. I'll tell this. So this is when we thought it was all over and we were going to the pub. This is my mate Phoebe, who kind of works in the town. She comes up to me and she says, you actually need to move everything that you've put out that you're going to move tomorrow. You need to move it to this like one office. And then we did that and it started torrentially raining. The weather was mad. We had a meteor shower, we had a blood red moon, we had this random storm, and we had the biggest heat wave in history. And it was like one weekend. Me and Andy, who's the David Bowie lookalike in the back, we kind of moved that stuff at the last minute and got absolutely drenched. That's the end. I've not really kind of planned a speech, but I think I just wanted to say it's happening again. Not this summer, but the one after, so August 2022. Prepare your calendars. Figure out how to prepare your calendars. I'm so used to saying August 2022 from like promoting that one. We're going to do it again. We're going to try and get some more money because I don't have enough mates to do mates rates again. You should come. It was a really good laugh, and we're trying to make something really good. Thank you.
Okay, hello everyone. I'm very glad we've got a show and tell to follow all the excitement we've got so far. Thank you for having us here today. I'm Caroline Harris, and as well as being a PhD student with Roar Holloway and part of the Poetics Research Centre, I run a small press, Small Birds Press. And Bryony Hughes here is editor at Osmosis Press. So we are here today. We're going to begin by talking a little bit about how some of our experiences and approaches in small press publishing link into some of the approaches of the New York School or schools. And then we're going to talk through some specific examples, and that's when you'll get some things handed round. So first of all, the title. So it's taken from an Andrew Epstein quote on his Locus Solus website. And really, as soon as I told Bryony about the quote, we just felt it really applied so much to our roles as small press publishers and actually our whole approach. So the whole of the quote reads, "I prefer to see the New York School as a very loose constellation of poets, artists, composers, etc., that spans several generations and that has tentacles in many different spheres. In many different spheres of culture and in different time periods." So this octopus-like image, and this is an AI octopus, by the way, this octopus-like image of poetic relationships struck us both as appropriate. And hopefully you'll see some tentacular kind of relationships between what each of us is going to say. Good change, thank you. So, for example, we felt it really captures the way that the visual side and the literary side come together in all of our work. So this, in fact, shows four books published by Tiber Press in 1960 that were collaborations between New York School poets and artists of the time. So for both Small Birds Press and Osmosis Press, this kind of linkage of the text, textuality, texture, textiles, with the visual aspects, really thinking through materiality is really at the core of what we're doing.
Hi. As Caroline mentioned, my name is Bryony, and I'm going to start by talking a little bit about my own work. So one of the major tensions I encounter when talking about my creative practice is the question of where do I situate or align my work? And learning out of Redl Olson's wonderful poetic practice pathway, I've been introduced to adopt new methodologies of writing, from kind of moving between site responsive work, the development of book arts, working from the archive, found materials and fragments, lyric articulation, events scores, the Fluxus movement, poets theatre, sound and concrete poetry. I could keep listing. I actually do have a much longer list, but I'm going to stop there, which is very, very exciting. And I think that Alice Notley, when interviewed by Jennifer Dick, articulated this feeling well when she said, "If I were to say what I most feel a part of, it's not the New York School, but it's the generation of women poets my age who cut across all the ways that American poetry is written." So I wouldn't describe personally this kind of wavering situatedness as an anxiety or a difficulty, but rather more of an opportunity to exist in somewhat of a primordial soup of poetic generation. And also community. Community is so important, especially at Royal Holloway. And I think it's important to both acknowledge and hold a critical appreciation for the borders between, say, New York School writing and projective poetics, but also feel kind of empowered to complicate these parameters and to find moments of porosity. Maggie Nelson describes this cutting across as using the metaphor of water, and she says, "There's been a great deal of fluidity and affinity, personally, textually, and critically, between women writing in the New York School vein and women associated with language writing." And I'm really interested in this kind of gendered fluidity, not just because, for those of you who know my work, I love a good water analogy, but in relation to a return to the Epstein quote that Caroline introduced, borrowed for the title of this paper. Tentacular octopus bodies, they can kind of radically alter in shape, they fit through small gaps, they're very kind of liquid, but they're also radically whole, and I think that's really important.
So one of the things that I've come across recently researching around women in visual poetry, for example, is the relative lack of lack of representation in anthologies. And this is something that Amanda Earle sought to try and redress with this book, Judith, Women Making Visual Poetry.
So Earl writes, over the years, I've been told numerous times by male publishers, editors, and visual poets that few women make visual poetry. And judging from visual poetry anthologies published in the 21st century, this appeared to be true. Earl goes on to then note the kind of cognitive dissonance that she feels when comparing that with her actual experience of the amount of work out there by women visual poets, whether it's on Etsy or Instagram or other kinds of platforms. And I recently wrote an article for the online journal of craft and art and modernism and feminism called Decorating Dissidents, kind of drawing attention to some of the networks of women visual artists, women visual poets that I've kind of come into contact with. Because I do feel, you know, we're kind of making some of our own platforms here. The small press publishing, there's a growing network of people interconnecting with each other. And I wanted also to bring that into a different kind of space by putting it not on a kind of a traditional poetry platform, but bringing it into a different kind of journal. As I was saying, we've been making our own kind of networks and collaborations, and in some ways being our own audiences as well. Okay, so right.
Fabulous. So, as mentioned before, we're going to do a little bit of a show and tell, because I feel like that's the perfect way to end the day. But I just want to mention that I suppose I choose to work within and create spaces that are kind of interdisciplinary, for community and collaborative generation, and where kind of porosity or complicated parameters become centered rather than on the margins. So first up, my first kind of intervention, if I could call it that, into the UK publishing landscape. Yeah, absolutely. Was the Crested Tick Collective, which was a group of the numbers kind of changed, but approximately 8 poets who were women and non-binary poets who came out of the poetic practice pathway at Royal Holloway. We were really, really interested in kind of promoting each other. We were our own audiences, but we also wanted to get each other's work out into the world. So we were working with artist books, and we were also kind of hosting spaces for readings. But during the pandemic, that shifted slightly. Obviously, we were all under lockdown, and we ended up developing Rewilding, which was our first printed anthology. And the reason why I raised this, it was a really exciting opportunity for me to kind of expand what I would expect to be in the space of an anthology. So when we were asking for the call for submissions, we weren't just asking for kind of pieces of written poetry, but we were looking for ephemera, documentation of performance, of sculpture, of book arts, you name it, it's kind of in there. From that experience, I then developed Osmosis Press, which I've got some books to pass around as well. So Caroline is actually, has just as a little plug, Caroline's latest pamphlet is going to be launched from Osmosis in the next few weeks. So you will get a sneak peek of that. But Osmosis sets out to make space for kind of the in-between, so work that cuts across multiple methodologies and traditions, but also functions as a community space. We're kind of growing, and it's a lovely community to be a part of. The other aspect of my kind of work within books is my own creative practice. So as mentioned when I was introduced, thank you, I'm doing my PhD currently at Royal Holloway, and as part of that, the work that I'm producing is a series of book arts and performance objects. And I've got a couple with me today, and these kind of push the boundaries, I hope, of what a book can be. So the first one that I'm going to pass along is a very kind of quite long, hand-marbled, thermo-printed scroll. This is called Weather Dialogue. I've actually printed a 60-foot-long one as well, but I didn't bring that along today because I thought that would be quite intense. Am I okay to pass that in that direction?
Are we okay to just...
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a book, so I'm very happy for you to handle it in the same way that you would handle a book. That's completely okay. If it rips, it rips. Dog ear. and then the other piece that I've got to hand around is Mudlarks, and this was one of the first pieces that I made as part of the PhD. And this is a series of eight kind of debossed poems on pieces of paper that I made using recycled materials and water from the Thames. The text itself comes from language and objects that I mudlocked from the Thames as well. So I will pass that around. Once again, you're welcome to hold these, hold them up to the light. It's sometimes quite difficult to see the type on the page. Oh,
thank you.
Sorry, didn't go through all the slides. There we go.
So slightly differently to Bryony's background, I come from a background in actual trade publishing. So I've been used to putting text and images together in books, but in a slightly different context. So kind of doing books about ice cream and craft and that kind of thing. But being involved in the whole conceptualization of how image, visuals, graphics, text all work together to kind of put across what you're trying to say. And so for me, I was kind of bringing that into poetry as well. I've also done some research into small press publishing kind of more generally and into post-digital publishing. And I just wanted to read a quote from a chapter I did in Contemporary Publishing and the Culture of Books, published by Routledge. For emerging post-digital publishers, there is no print versus digital. No either or. The two are companions and interconnected. The new entrants publish and share ideas, stories, and images across multiple platforms, from beautifully designed hardback print books to personalized titles, ebooks, magazines, video, web, merchandise, podcasts, events, and social media. In this setting, a book becomes one option among many, chosen when it's the most appropriate form. And I think, you know, we're really thinking about what is the most appropriate form for everything we do, whether it's a hand-marbled scroll, or whether it's a work in textiles, or whether it's a pamphlet. So I noticed as well that there's quite a trend for kind of lots of people coming into small press publishing from other routes. So whether it's like Verve Poetry Press, starting out as a festival, or you have Lunar Editions coming from a podcast, and you have, for example, J.D. House's Permeable Barrier coming from a multimedia website. So there's a lot more interconnections now, and certainly as well in the whole way that books are conceived, the way they're put together, the way they're printed, distributed, and publicized. You know, we have tentacles across many different media forms as well in small press publishing. So I was just going to introduce a couple of my projects. So if I can... So I actually started Small Birds Press initially to show my own handmade works. So everything on the site is, though it's kind of partly inkjet printed, it's like all limited edition and it's all handmade. And this work, Clootie Ribbons, which refers to the Gaelic tradition of hanging wishing ribbons in trees, this was commissioned for the Art Park Gallery in Rhodes by Astra Papa Christodoulou. And it's a series of, it's actually the text of the pamphlet that Bryony showed you, which was originally conceived for these linen ribbons. And when it's in the box, and please feel free to take it out, it kind of, as Astra pointed out to me, it looks like a codex form, but then it can be recombined and read in many different ways when it's hanging in the trees. And this kind of tactility is a materiality is really important to everything I'm doing with the press. So, and then the second piece that I wanted to show is the first collaboration for Small Birds Press. This was actually made for the Runnymede Literature Festival this year, and it's a collaboration with the very talented poet Kat Chong. And so what I did was I took the origami deers. So I took two pieces of Kat's texts, and I used the actual folding of the origami deers as a poetic process. I then transcribed the text and made the 7 Chimera poems for Kat Trong from it. And then, I'm afraid I don't have it here today, but this is Kat's response to my work, where they combine a number of my poems as well into a collage poem, hand-typed this one onto a long piece of receipt paper. And I hope this will be the beginning of more collaborations. There's also, I haven't got photos of it here, but if you want to have a look, I've got some, I mentioned these to Sophie earlier, some poetry tarot cards. Yes, fantastic.
So as Caroline and myself were kind of preparing for this panel, we have also been working on a joint exhibition with Astropath Christodoulou, who was mentioned earlier by Caroline. So I feel like this is a nice opportunity, seeing as you're all a willing audience, to just let you know that this will be starting on Tuesday this week at the Winning Gallery, which is just outside of Hampton Court Palace. And there are flyers lurking outside. But it's been really lovely speaking to you. And if you have any questions at some point, yeah, please do ask them.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have 8-10 minutes of questions possible. If anyone would like to ask any questions of any of our panelists, that would be great. Now's the time. If not, can I immediately abuse my chairman's privileges and ask one myself? I think this is an incredibly eclectic range of papers, to say the least. And I know lots of things now that I didn't know before, like Kirby Lonsdale is the next New York. So that's all good. But it struck me that one thing that's going on all around is that... in the way that Frank O'Hara says, now canonically acceptable, women abstract expressionist painters have been in the Whitechapel Gallery over the last 6 months. Joe Mitchell is coming to Tate Britain, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Helen Frankenthaler exhibited. So you have a widening of attention, which rebalances some prejudice and imbalances. To have those artists enter a mainstream just at the moment where maybe the mainstream doesn't exist or is about to not exist as it dissolves, evaporates, or whatever mainstreams do, becomes tributaries, disappears in rivers under rivers. So we've seen books that aren't books, and I'm glad I didn't touch the one that was made partly from Thames water.
Oh, it's clean. I boiled the water, don't worry.
You boiled the water. I'll happily read that book. Yeah. But I hope you see where I might be going with this, that, you know, where is the mainstream that these entities are joining? Is there one? And who are the communities now to gain sustenance from the incredible range of things that have been talked about? Right, I'll stop now.
Yeah. I was struck with by the reoccurrence of the figure wavering in Nick's talk, wavering and multiplication as an eco-poetics, and then Brian and Carolyn spoke to a wavering situatedness. I was sort of wondering if there's something about the lack of a New York, right, for poetry nowadays. Creeley's pieces, that's very much sort of the poetry of travel. I mean, he's moving out, he's moving around, you know, hello, it's, and hello, you know, the book, sort of, I read those as very unrooted. I mean, it's sort of a portable poetic. So I'm just wondering about, for any of you, not just Nick, Carol, and Brian, if there's a kind of wavering poetics is that a desired effect, or is that a fact of our times and the precarity?